Nick Seabrook is a constitutional scholar and a professor of political science at the University of North Florida. His new book is One Person, One Vote, A Surprising History of Gerrymandering in America. The book is just out and is a look at the political practice that goes back to before the Revolutionary War, with the writing, rewriting, and striking down of political maps in recent weeks. The book leaves us to try to answer some of the questions like, what in the world is happening? Again, the name of the book is One Person, One Vote, and we welcome Nick Seabrook to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on our program.
Thanks, Joe. It's good to be here.
How much was this guided by what we knew was going to come out of the 2020 census?
A lot of it. So one of the things that struck me was how much of the conversation surrounding gerrymandering always seems to focus on what's happening right now, how the districts are being drawn in your state, what implications gerrymandering might have for upcoming elections, lawsuits that are playing out in federal or state court, as has been happening in New York and where I am in Florida as well. And so what I tried to do with the book was to try and shift the conversation away from the present and look at both the past and the future of gerrymandering, how, as you say, it's not just a modern phenomenon. It's something that's been happening throughout American history, even going back to before the United States was a country. And gerrymandering has played a key role in some of the most important events in U.S. history, from the creation of the Bill of Rights to the effects that it had on the Civil War and Reconstruction. It played a key role in the Civil Rights Movement and the fight for racial equality. And I really found it amazing as I was researching the book just how often gerrymandering has kind of intersected with the lives and the careers of some of our most famous political figures, people like James Madison and Abraham Lincoln, and how its effects have fundamentally altered the course of U.S. history. But I also wanted to think about the future as well and ask the question of what we can do about gerrymandering moving forward. This is one of the biggest threats that exists to American democracy today, I think, and how we can safeguard our democracy and make it more responsive to the will of the people. And if I had to sum up the message of the book in a single phrase, it would probably be that the voters should be choosing their politicians. The politicians should not be choosing their voters.
So I certainly want to talk about all of that. Before we do, let us just get a baseline, and that is the definition, your working definition for the purposes of the book, for the purposes of this conversation, of what gerrymandering is.
So I tried to define gerrymandering fairly broadly. In the book, we tend to think of it as having to do specifically with the drawing of political districts, but I widened it slightly to encompass the intentional manipulation of political boundaries for some kind of political gain. Often it's district boundaries, but I also uncovered examples of the gerrymandering of municipal boundaries, basically redrawing the definition of a city to exclude certain voters and to include others. And I also documented examples of territorial gerrymandering as well, that in the Civil War era and after that, the Republican Party essentially gerrymandered the boundaries of the American territories so that when they were eventually admitted as states, they would contribute votes for the party in the Senate. But fundamentally, it involves intent. It involves some kind of political boundary, and it involves some kind of political goal, some outcome that the person doing that manipulation is attempting to achieve.
Over history, how has that, from the beginning, which I'm hoping you can address, of how that has morphed and changed over the decades?
So a lot of the historical instances of gerrymandering kind of appear somewhat ham-fisted by the standards of how we judge the practice today, including the eponymous quote-unquote original gerrymander supposedly perpetrated by Governor Elbridge Gerry of Massachusetts, and the practice was actually pronounced gerrymandering for about the first 50 years after that, until the pronunciation kind of evolved into the more natural gerrymandering. And looking even earlier than that, the gerrymander that was put in place by Patrick Henry in Virginia, less than a year after the Constitution was ratified, to try and deny his arch rival James Madison a seat in the first Congress, the Congress that produced the Bill of Rights that Madison, of course, was integral to. But these were not especially successful endeavors. Patrick Henry's original Henrymander did not prevent James Madison from getting elected. In fact, he won that election in a landslide. The original Massachusetts gerrymander was not especially effective either. And part of the reason for that, I think, is that historically, politicians who have undertaken gerrymandering have lacked really good quality data on the voting populations. They've lacked the technology to be able to manipulate and fine-tune and tailor the districts in the way that routinely happens today. And most importantly, I think they've lacked the ability to kind of see into the future, to predict with any reasonable degree of accuracy how districts that they draw are likely to perform in elections 2, 3, 4 cycles down the road. So a lot of historical gerrymanders were a way that politicians kind of put their thumbs on the scale for an election or two. But the gerrymanders that we see today in places like Wisconsin and their state legislature have become a mechanism by which a party can almost permanently entrench itself in power. The GOP controlled redistricting in Wisconsin after the 2010 census, and they were able to draw the state legislative boundaries in such a way that they've basically maintained control of 2/3 of the seats in both legislative chambers in all of the elections that have been held since. And that includes elections where the Democrats actually won the popular vote overall. And that's kind of the difference between gerrymandering historically, which was not especially effective, and gerrymandering today, which is really devastatingly effective.
Let us not bury the lead here, but you make the very clear point in the book that this is democracy's greatest threat. We have many threats to our democracy, whether it be the Electoral College or lifetime appointments for the Supreme Court justices. But gerrymandering, in certainly having to do with the redrawing of congressional, state, and local districts for political gain, is of great concern to you and, of course, to other political historians. There does seem to be, we talked about the history that dates back quite far, and you touched on this a moment ago, but I'd just like to go back to it a little bit, of the differences that we saw in the 1960s, that we saw following in during the civil rights movement of what was being done and how that idea of one person, one vote started to come out from that.
Right, because prior to that reapportionment revolution, as I term it in the book, in the 1960s, that series of Supreme Court cases that made it a constitutional mandate that within a legislative chamber, all of the districts had to have equal populations, that everyone's influence, everyone's vote should count the same for the purposes of electing their representatives in government. Prior to that, redistricting was, in many states, something that happened only occasionally. There are instances that I documented of states going 30, 40, sometimes even 50 or 60 years without redrawing their district boundaries. And that had profound consequences for the allocation of political power. You had rural districts in certain states that had extremely small populations. You had urban districts that had extremely large populations. And this really produced an outsized influence for rural constituents in their state legislatures and in Congress. And these rural politicians were able to resist calls for redistricting because the way things were allocated was to their benefit. But ever since those Supreme Court decisions in the 1960s, we now find ourselves in a situation where redistricting has to happen in every state every decade after we get a new census. They have to redraw the boundaries because that's the only way to remain in compliance with one person, one vote. And with redistricting becoming ubiquitous, the temptation for politicians to use gerrymandering to influence the outcomes of subsequent elections has become a much greater concern, because the incentives that having politicians in control of drawing the districts that either they themselves or their allies, fellow members of their political party will run in are they're perverse incentives. It's an unavoidable conflict of interest. And with redistricting happening all the time, gerrymandering has become more prevalent. And because they've had to kind of work around this mandate that districts have equal populations, they've kind of resorted to more ingenious and devious methods for achieving what they could previously achieve just by having districts that had wildly different populations.
Nick Seabrook is our guest. His new book is One Person, One Vote, A Surprising History of Gerrymandering in America. You make the point of where we are now is that the number of competitive seats has been declining every decade and is now at its lowest point in probably 100 years. So what do we do with that information, especially knowing that a conservative majority Supreme Court will allow more of this to exist, and that redistricting will go that way? What are the solutions? Are they achievable? And because my reading of your book is there's not a lot of good news here.
Yeah, I've been confronted with the somewhat pessimistic conclusion of the book from the reaction of readers. And what I say is that I think there is a sliver of optimism in there. One of the most encouraging signs, I think, is that redistricting, gerrymandering, is extremely unpopular across the political spectrum. If you look both at the polling numbers, and additionally, you look at what happens when people are actually given the opportunity to vote on redistricting reform, there seems to be a bipartisan consensus that our present system is untenable. And it's something that's reasonably easy to sell. You can sell doing something about gerrymandering to Republicans by pointing at what's happened in places like New York and Illinois and Maryland, where Democrats have been subverting democracy. And you can appeal to Democrats by pointing out the situations where Republicans have done it. Generally, the fight against gerrymandering has been fought in courtrooms, and mostly in federal courtrooms. And it has not really been an especially successful fight. And that culminated with the Supreme Court's decision in 2018, the Roberts Court, essentially saying that we're not even going to entertain these disputes anymore when it comes to the federal judiciary, which means that all that's left to us at this point is state-level lawsuits in state courts based on state constitutions. And there has been some success on that front this time around. It was a lawsuit that got the Democratic New York gerrymander of the congressional districts there struck down. We've seen that happen in other states as well, but the problem with lawsuits is that they're costly, they're time-consuming, there's no real guarantee of success. We've seen in places like Kansas and here in Florida that state courts have allowed badly gerrymandered district maps to remain in place, which is why I think that the best solution moving forward, and this is something where we've seen quite a bit of progress over the last couple of decades, is to try and put initiatives on the ballot at the state level to remove control over redistricting from state legislatures, from politicians, and to create independent commissions that are not subject to political influence. And you're not always going to get a fair map every time when you do that, but at the very least you get a fair process, and one that doesn't have those perverse incentives that that infect the political branches, where you have people who are unbeholden to those who are in office.
You mentioned your home state of Florida, but the most egregious examples that we're seeing right now seem to be in Florida and Texas.
Yeah, and I think this kind of calls back to the earlier point that I made about gerrymandering kind of holding up and remaining robust sometimes throughout an entire decade, because what's happened both here in Florida, in Texas, in Wisconsin, is that Republicans drew the lines a decade ago, and the gerrymanders that they put in place were sufficiently effective to keep them in control. And so they've kind of fine-tuned them this time around. In Texas, they focused on kind of shoring up the seats that the GOP already held. In Wisconsin, we've seen what we call least change type maps, maps that don't fundamentally reorder the political landscape, but kind of reinforce what is an already fairly unbalanced and unfair alignment based on how people in the state actually vote. And here in Florida, we've seen now 2 decades of the Republican Party gerrymandering our districts, despite the fact that in 2010, Floridians approved an amendment to the state constitution that supposedly banned gerrymandering. And what happened a decade ago is that the Republicans in Tallahassee went ahead and gerrymandered anyway. There was about a 5-year legal campaign that did result in a couple of those maps getting struck down. But gerrymandering affects not only who gets elected, it can fundamentally undermine a political party's competitiveness in a state. It can prevent them from recruiting good candidates if there's no meaningful opportunity for them to compete for control. And that's kind of what happened here in Florida. The Democrats have been on the outside for so long that the party infrastructure has started to atrophy. It's hard to recruit people to run for seats. And the state has kind of trended more and more in the Republican direction. And it's concerning. And it's just as concerning when it happens in states that Democrats control as well.
Well, and that's a point that I find fascinating that you make in the book, which is that, look, because whenever we discuss this on our show and listeners weigh in, they're very quick to remind us that both parties do this readily. And the reason you give and the point you make, I think, is fascinating, that Republicans may be no more devious or are no more devious in doing this than Democrats are, but the Republicans have had much better timing on it.
Right, and a lot of the developments and the Republican successes in gerrymandering can be traced back to the wave election of 2010. It was kind of a perfect storm of a midterm election where you had a Democrat in office in President Obama. It came at a time when his approval ratings were not especially robust. Presidents tend to lose seats during midterm elections anyway, and the results of 2010 dictated who would get to control redistricting after that census. And all of those factors kind of broke in favor of the Republicans. And they took control of state legislatures, not just in red states, but in a lot of swing states as well, places like Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Ohio, North Carolina, Florida. And they controlled the drawing of districts in all of those states. And because those effects kind of ripple forward through all of the elections that we've had since then, they're still kind of reaping some of those benefits today. And we're able to retain control in 2020, partly because of the lingering effects of those earlier gerrymanders. But you only have to go back to the 1980s to find a situation where the shoe was very much on the other foot, and it was Democrats who dominated state legislatures. It was Democrats who were gerrymandering in places like California, and it was the Republicans who were arguing in court that the judges and justices should step in and put a stop to this. Ronald Reagan even came out against gerrymandering and criticized Democrats in California, and he famously signed a petition in the White House Rose Garden to try and put an initiative on the ballot in California to reverse the Democratic gerrymander that had happened after the 1980 census. So I think it's important to have long memories when it comes to this question, and just because Republicans seem to be doing better right now doesn't mean that that's always going to be the case. We've seen in places like New York and Illinois that when they have the opportunity, Democrats are just as willing to subvert democracy if it gives them an electoral edge as Republicans are.
The name of the book, One Person, One Vote, A Surprising History of Gerrymandering in America. The book is published by Pantheon. Nick Seabrook, a great pleasure to have you on the program. I thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks, Joe. It was a pleasure.
A great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the name of the book is One Person, One Vote, A Surprising History of Gerrymandering in America. Nick Seabrook is a professor in the Department of Political Science and Public Administration at the University of North Florida. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.